Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:31 p.m. It's Monday, March 22nd. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I would ask all committee members and everyone else in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Drummond, Representative Kirka, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Snyder by teams, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 109, Extend Bar Association Board of Governors, sponsored by my office. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to present to the bill is my Chief of Staff, Lizzie Kubitz. Ms. Kubitz, if you please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Representative Matt Clayman. House Bill 109 extends the termination date of the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association until June 30th, 2029, in accordance with the recommendation of the legislative auditor. The board is currently scheduled to terminate on June 30th, 2021. The Division of Legislative Audit, having concluded an audit of the Board of Governors, determined that the board is operating in the public's interest and has complied with its duties and responsibilities to the public. It recommends that the termination date be extended to June 30th, 2029. The Division of Legislative Audit has also determined that the Board of Governors should again recommend to the Alaska Supreme Court that it amend the Alaska Bar Rules so as to increase the number of mandatory continuing legal education credit hours, commonly known as CLE hours. Currently, bar members shall complete 3 hours of ethics CLE and may complete 9 hours of general CLE. The Board of Governors serves an important public service by regulating the practice of law, promoting reform in the law and in judicial procedure, facilitating the administration of justice, investigating complaints, requiring continuing legal education for membership, and increasing the public service and efficiency of the bar. I'd like to pass it over to Chris Curtis, legislative auditor, and I would ask the committee members to hold their questions until she has finished her testimony. I'll also note for the record that we have 3 other individuals joining us via Teams today, and they are available for questions. That is Ben Hoffmeister, President of the Board of Governors Alaska Bar Association, Phil Shanahan, Bar Counsel to the Alaska Bar Association, and Danielle Bailey, Executive Director of the Alaska Bar Association. Thank you, and I will turn it over to Ms. Curtis.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kubitz. Before we turn it over to Ms. Curtis, I'd like to disclose for the record that I am a member of the Alaska Bar Association. And next, to continue our presentation, is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor, Division of Legislative Audit. Ms. Curtis, thank you for coming forward. Please identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your State Legislative Auditor. Division of Legislative Audit did conduct an audit of the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association. The purpose of a sunset audit is to determine whether a board or commission is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. I believe you have a copy of the audit report in your meeting packets. I'll be referring to it once or twice during the presentation. It's dated June of 2020. So our audit concluded that the board served the public's interest by effectively admitting qualified members to the bar and by investigating complaints made against bar members. We are recommending an 8-year extension, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. If you turn to page 8 of the audit, you will see a schedule of admission and exam statistics. It covers the periods calendar years 2017 through 2019. On average, 120 members were admitted to the bar each year, and on average, the exam pass rate was 54%. The audit reviewed a random sample of 15 new member applications and found all met admission requirements. If you turn back now to page 6, you'll see disciplinary statistics. Between January 2017 and December 2019, 689 complaints were filed with the bar. 82% were not accepted for further investigation because the complaints were incomplete, did not identify ethical misconduct, or were not within the bar's jurisdiction. 5 complaints resulted in discipline, and 89 of the complaints were still open at the time of our audit. To promote competency and professionalism, active bar members are required to obtain 3 hours of continuing education each year, and they are encouraged to voluntarily obtain 9 additional hours. The number of mandatory continuing education hours are significantly below the requirements of other states, most other states. As of March 2020, 37 states required at least 12 education hours each year. The low number of mandatory continuing education hours has been a finding in the prior 3 sunset audits. In 2011, the board formed a committee to review the mandatory continuing education program. The review included electronically surveying bar members. 91% of the over 900 bar members that responded to the survey did not favor increasing the mandatory education hours. Okay, moving out of report conclusions and into findings and recommendations, we're going to start on page 11. First, we recommend the bar's executive director ensure meetings are properly posted on the state's online public notice system. Of the 9 meetings we reviewed, 7 were not published on the state's online public notice system, and 6 did not include public comment as an agenda item. According to the executive director, the notices were posted in a publication, the bar's publication called the Bar Rag, and they were posted on the bar's website. But technically, that does not comply with the law that does require that they be posted on the state's public notice system. Second recommendation can be found on page 8. The board should improve internal controls over the bar's online admission system and case database. The audit identified 2 deficiencies that could affect the security and availability of data. Pertinent details were communicated to management in a separate confidential document, and management did provide legislative audit corrective action. The details are not reported in the audit to help ensure that the weaknesses are not exploited. The third recommendation also starts on page 12. The board should recommend an increase in the non-ethics mandatory continuing legal education for attorneys. Although in 2019, 99% of bar members completed the mandatory ethics education, only 55 voluntarily completed the 9 additional hours. Now, continuing education is important because it benefits the public and the profession by helping ensure that attorneys remain competent regarding the law and the profession's obligations and standards. Management's response to the audit begins on page 29. The court system's general counsel agrees that the board should make a new recommendation on the number of mandatory continuing education hours for the court's consideration. The board's response begins on page 31. The board agrees with recommendations 1 and 2, and in regards to recommendation number 3, which is the recommendation regarding mandatory continuing education, the board agreed to discuss the appointment of a committee to review the mandatory education at its October 2020 meeting.
Thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. I will note again, I think we identified earlier that the current president of the Board of Governors, Ben Hoffmeister, is available for questions, as is Phil Shanahan, Bar Counsel, and Daniel Bailey, the executive director. Are there questions for any members of the committee for Ms. Curtis or any of the folks online? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, I think you listed 2 duties of the bar, and that was admitting applicants and dealing with disciplinary issues. Does the Bar Association have any other duties, or is that it?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, if you turn to page 1 of the audit, it's what we call the organization and function section, and it goes through and describes the board composition, and on page 2, it talks about the board's 2 primary functions. And it's an interesting dynamic because of how the Supreme Court and the bar work together to oversee the legal occupation. Our profession.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
And have we in statute or you know, in other official policy delegated any other responsibilities or duties to the Bar Association? Or I guess is that seems like a pretty short list. I know I had heard discussion about their involvement with, like, judicial selection, things like that, but I'm not clear on some of the details.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, we say that the board's purpose includes regulating the practice of law, so regulation, promoting reform in the law and the judicial procedure, facilitating the administration of justice, encouraging legal education, administering the bar exam, admitting members to the bar, disciplining the bar, and that's typical of any occupational board, really. You've got licensing, reviewing continuing education courses, admitting members to the occupation, continually evaluating regulations and tweaking regulations. So they do provide similar functions that you see in other occupational boards.
Thank you.
Representative Kirker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking at the, I guess, the makeup of the bar and its composition and how many attorneys and how many non-attorney, or how many members are appointed by the governor and how many are appointed internally. And I haven't really compared that to other boards and commissions, but it seems like the normal process is the chief executive, the governor, would appoint members to a board, a state board, and then be confirmed by the legislature. This seems kind of lopsided to being controlled heavily by the Bar Association without input from the legislature.
Through the chair, I never really considered that. It is true that this association appoints its members, and then the governor only appoints three. And typically, you'll see the governor on an occupational board appointing more. I don't really have the background on that to really talk about why that's the case.
Follow-up?
So you're not aware of any other boards that are structured this way, occupational boards, where it comes in from the industry, from internally, not from the governor?
Through the chair.
Which is kind of lopsided, if I understand what you're saying. You're not familiar enough with.
Well, through the chair, there's plenty of other boards, maybe not occupational boards, that have a identified composition that might come from other places. I don't have any statistics for you.
Okay, and then one last question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kirker.
So I was thinking of, in relation to Representative Eastman's question, through the chair, is it not also true that the Board of Governors selects, or that the board, or do the members at large of the bar select the appointees, the attorney appointee to the Judicial Council?
Just for clarification, Representative Kirk is asking about the three members of the Judicial Council that are selected by the Bar Association.
To the chair, I don't. We did not look at that specifically.
Okay.
We have no comment about that.
Any other questions for any of the folks on Teams or for Ms. Curtis?
Yes, Chair Clayton. This is Rep. Snyder.
Go ahead, Rep. Snyder. Thanks for speaking up, because it's hard to see you waving your hand on Teams. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, through the chair. These seem like some pretty essential primary functions. If this were to be terminated, who would pick that up, and what are some of the anticipated repercussions?
Well, through the chair, I really don't have a good answer for that. You know, typically, if it's an occupational board, it falls within the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And if the board goes away, the licensing function just reverts back to the department, and there is no break in the actual occupation. I don't know what would happen if that was the case. We've never considered that. With this particular board, rather than it terminating, I see this process more as an oversight, legislative oversight process, as opposed to actually considering it for termination, similar to the Board of Parole and those type of boards.
Ms. Carter, just for purposes of the joys with Teams and everything else, think the process is, the reason they address the questions through the chair is that you still answer the questions to the chair even though it came from an individual member. I know it seems awkward and somewhat bizarre, but that's just kind of how it rolls. Go ahead, Representative Snyder. I was actually going to just add one piece to that picture, is that unlike other boards, because the licensing of attorneys, it's in the end a matter for the court, because the court is a third branch of government, is the people who are admitted to practice before the court. Unlike any other board, it's not really entirely clear that it could go back to another part of the executive branch, because the supervision in the end is ultimately the court's responsibility and not the executive branch's responsibility. Mr. Hoffmeister, who I know is in the Attorney General's office, Mr. Shannon, or Ms. Bailey may actually have more to offer on that particular issue. And if you want them to provide some follow-up, if you want to go ahead with your own follow-up, Ms. Snyder, Representative Snyder, that's fine.
I'll just throw one extra little question, then if there's a combined answer, that would be great. I was just curious about the word terminate. It sounds like maybe there's a pushback to the appropriateness of that term, but that is the term used in the audit we were provided. And maybe I'm missing something, but if there's some clarification there, that'd be helpful too.
Through the chair, there is a sunset date in statute for this board. So technically, it would go away, terminate, if there's not a bill submitted to the legislature to formally extend the board.
Any of the folks from the Bar Association want to add any perspective with regard to this particular function, should the legislature not extend the sunset date, and who's supervising and how that works? Mr. Hoffmeister.
Through the chair and to Representative Snyder and the rest of the committee, first of all, I do want to clarify, I do work for the Attorney General's office, but I'm not here in my capacity as an assistant attorney general. I'm here as the Alaska Bar president. But we've actually analyzed this at least briefly in prior conversations with the Board of Governors in the almost 3 years that I've been involved. And I agree wholeheartedly with what Representative Klayman said, which is that the functions would fall underneath the court, specifically the Supreme Court. So if this were terminated, we would probably follow the same model of other states that do not have a bar association like we do. If I remember correctly, one of the states that we looked to was Nebraska, and all their disciplinary and admissions issues fall directly under the Supreme Court, which would also terminate the funding source that comes from our dues, and that would be something that the legislature would have to pick up in terms of funding all the things that we do that are pointed out in Ms. Curtis's legislative audit report.
Representative Snyder, any other follow-up?
No, thank you. That was very helpful.
Representative Price Tompkins, I think I saw your hand up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think this is a question for Mr. Hoffmeister or Ms. Bailey, which is noting the results of the member survey about increasing the number of CLE hours required. Does the bar have a position about what may happen to the current requirement?
I can answer that. Thank you for the record. My name is Danielle Bailey. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Bar Association. Through the chair, to that end, we received the audit, we then formed the MCLE subcommittee, and we've had 5 meetings at this time. At this point, that committee has decided that they will not be polling the membership, and that it is looking like they are going to increase the number of CLE hours. However, their work is not yet finished, and that recommendation would go to the board, and the board has not had time to process all those results yet. But that is as far as we are in the process.
And just for a slight degree of clarity, even if the board were to suggest increasing the number of mandatory continuing legal education hours, that would ultimately be a decision for the Supreme Court. So in 2009, when they added the mandatory ethics CLE requirement to the bar, that was that followed some years in which the board had suggested more than just the 3 hours of ethics, and the Supreme Court had rejected those on some requests. And then in 2009, or maybe it was 2008, but the board came back and, or the court came back and approved the 3 mandatory ethics hours. I'm not sure if that gives you some more context to your questioning, but I know much about that because I was president of the board at the time. Go ahead, Representative Price. Go ahead with your follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then for the committee's reference, at least my reference, in terms of fulfilling the CLE requirement, what does that look like and how does that work? For example, is there a list of offerings or courses or trainings that are approved by the Alaska Bar or the National Bar that one must select from in order to fulfill the CLE requirement, or sort of how restricted or regulated is that CLE process?
Thank you. Thank you, and through the chair. There are a variety of ways that attorney members can receive their CLE credits. Essentially, 1 hour of education equates to one CLE credit. And the Bar Association does have a lot of offerings. We do provide that information in our annual report every year to the legislature. And they also are free to get continuing legal education from other sources as well. So while we do provide a lot of offerings, there is free range to get that elsewhere.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And my question is to the auditor, and I was wondering, there seems to be an awful lot of focus in the audit on the CLE requirement. I'm wondering, how did that come to be one of the focus of the audit?
Through the chair, the criteria we use is in the appendix, I think Appendix A to the audit. We have a specifically statutory criteria we use to evaluate a board or commission. And one of them is to what extent they're operating in the public's interest. And given that this has been a finding in the previous 3 sunset audits, it was already on our radar to focus in and provide a current status of that prior recommendation.
Thank you. And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And you recommend 8 years, and I was wondering if you could speak to that. Why 8 years?
Through the chair, 8 years is the maximum allowed for in the sunset statutes. This board is operating fairly well. We don't have any serious concerns that, in my opinion, should impact the term of extension.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. Just on the financial picture, because there were some questions raised about, well, what happens if the legislature doesn't extend, is it your understanding that the dues collected from members are completely self-supporting for the Bar Association, or does it rely on any sort of state funds to run the Bar Association?
There is an appendix in the back that has their schedule of their statements of financial position showing their fund balance. It looks like they have adequate fund balance now to be self-supporting. So it's not, to my knowledge, they don't receive any direct funding from the legislature.
And from your knowledge of prior audits, was there ever a time in which the Bar Association relied on state funds to be self-supporting?
I can't answer that. I don't remember.
Okay. Pretty sure the answer is no, there was never a time, but I thought I would ask you if you knew that. Okay, I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 109. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, and the sound quality is, because the sound quality is not as clear, and it's often difficult to hear what you're saying. And I think Mr. Hoffmeister wanted to provide a brief statement on behalf of the Board of Governors as invited testimony. So, Mr. Hoffmeister, I will take you up first, and note at this point I don't see anyone else in the queue to provide public testimony. But go ahead, Mr. Hoffmeister.
To the chair, I actually didn't realize that I was being asked to do that, but I'd be more than happy to say a few words on behalf of the Board of Governors and the Bar Association. I think that the audit speaks for itself. I think Ms. Curtis's testimony and her comments today also are a positive note on the Bar Association and what we do. I believe it was Representative Eastman asked about the goals and the purposes of the Bar Association, and the focus, definitely, he was correct, that discipline and admissions are our primary focuses. But we also have purposes that are set out in our bylaws that Ms. Curtis explained. They're in Section 3 of Article 1 of the Alaska Bar Bylaws, and I'm just going to mention them again because I think they are important. And as bar president, when I'm considering different initiatives that the Bar Association and the Board of Governors is taking on, I constantly find myself going back to these five purposes. They are to regulate the practice of law, promote reform in the law and in judicial procedure, facilitate the administration of justice, encourage continuing legal education for the membership, and increase the public service and efficiency of the bar. And I think all of those are very important, and I feel as though not only do we do an excellent job of that, but we have a staff, an organization, the Bar Association, that knows what they're doing. There's two people that are here with me today, Phil Shannon, and he serves as bar counsel, and Danielle Bailey, she's the executive director. Now, they are both amazing attorneys who have taken on roles very recently and have led the machine that is the Bar Association on into 2021. As Representative Clayman or any other person from the bar can tell you, we've lost a lot of history in the last few years. Our prior executive director, Deborah O'Regan, the one that Ms. Curtis was actually working with the legislative audit and who provided the response from the Bar Association, just retired this last fall after 38 years of service. Ms. Bailey has come in and has done a phenomenal job of taking over the reins and keeping the level of service, particularly in this time when we're trying to deal with the impacts of a global pandemic. We have seamlessly moved on, and we will continue to do that as an organization. And I think that this is an important process, but I also think that the legislature, this committee, and anyone that reviews this particular audit should be comforted in the fact that we do a good job of those particular purposes, admissions and discipline, and we do every day try to give credence to the purposes in the bylaws of our of the Alaska bylaws. So I'd be happy to answer any more questions from the members of the committee, as would Mr. Shanahan or Ms. Bailey. We're here to provide any information that we can. But overall, we believe that the bill as proposed is solid, and it should pass through this committee.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. I see no one else in the room that would like to provide public testimony, and I have no one else online that would like to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony in this matter. I would just note, with regard to our new executive director, Ms. Bailey, that 38 years, I believe, is the longest serving executive director of any bar association in the history of the United States. And so Ms. O'Regan's service to the state and to the community has been exceptional, and I think Ms. Bailey is very capable of taking on the task, but it's going to take her a few years to get to that many years in service in that position. but it's a remarkable the length of time Deborah O'Regan served our state as a former bar president, and I think Mr. Hoffmeister serving both part of the time with Ms. O'Regan. She worked very effectively with more bar presidents than I would even begin to count, but the amazingly part is she remembers all of us. So. Representative Christ Tompkins.
And just a quick question, I think, for you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to remember what the term of the last termination extension was?
It's actually noted in the review. It was 8 years. Oh. The last extension was 8 years. All right. Hearing nothing further, we will hold this bill for further review. I will note, and I'll announce it again later, that amendments to House Bill 109 will be due electronically by 5 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, March 23rd. And we're going to take a brief at ease before we take up House Bill 29.
side, right?
That's right. Please come back to order. Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 29, Electric Utility Liability, sponsored by Representative Rauscher. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Rauscher and his staff, Jesse Logan. Please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 29. For the record, my name is George Rauscher, Representative of House District 9. HB 29 is a fairly straightforward bill. It makes clear that an electric utility would not be held liable for a fire caused by vegetation outside the utility's easement contacting electric facilities. The bill requires utilities to create, adopt, and adhere to a vegetation management plan that would mitigate the risks of contact with electrical facilities, lines for vegetation without their easement or within their easement and right of way. Ultimately, Mr. Chairman, this bill helps protect utilities from lawsuits that arise from things outside of the utility's control, and thus helps protect ratepayers by keeping their costs down. I'm going to ask my chief of staff, Jesse Logan, to further explain the bill for you. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Jesse Logan, staff to Representative Rauscher. As Representative said, House Bill 29 helps protect customers of electrical utilities by clarifying that the utility is not liable for fire damage caused by vegetation outside of the utility right-of-way and outside of its control. Without this clarity, legal liability with wildfires caused by vegetation contacting electrical lines poses a serious threat to Alaska's electrical utilities and consequently to their customers, which is all of us. The bill also stipulates that a utility will be held liable for damages that are the result of a fire from vegetation located entirely within the boundary of the right-of-way, or if the utility fails to have a written vegetation management plan or fails to comply with the plan. Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to remind the members of the public that the electric utilities are prohibited from entering adjacent properties without the consent of the property owner, but they can still be held liable for the damages that are the result of the vegetation located where they are prohibited to enter or manage. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, in the document provided to the committee, titled Electrical Utility Liability General Information that was produced by the Alaska Power Association, there's an example given from a 2015 case where litigation was brought against an electrical cooperative. In that instance, a spruce tree was located beyond the boundary of the utility easement, and it fell and contacted the cooperative's distribution line, resulting in a wildfire. Damaged property owners sued the utility, and while the case was eventually settled, the cooperative was required to defend the lawsuit. Those costs of the legal defense and the settlement would most likely result in a rate increase to the cooperative customers. I think it's also important for us all to remember that one of the main missions for an electrical utility is to provide reliable power. It is in the best interest of the utility, therefore, and its customers, to manage vegetation in a way that mitigates any risks that may occur. All the utilities that I'm aware of have adopted vegetation management plans as one of the many safety policies. A draft plan from Copper Valley Electric Association was provided to the committee as an example. And these management plans include such things as right-of-way maintenance schedules, hazard tree identification, removal methods, notifications, herbicide management, etc. I formerly worked as a renewable energy project manager and a safety policy coordinator for Kotzebue Electric Association. And even there in Kotzebue, where there is not one tree within 20 miles of the utility lines, we had a vegetation management plan. I bring this up only to illustrate that these management plans are commonplace and taken very seriously. So without the reforms of this proposed legislation, electric utilities would be held liable for things outside of their control, or they must look at other options that are prohibitively expensive to consumers, such as burying electric lines or widening the easements. Again, these costs would be passed on to the consumers. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, to be clear, this bill does not give immunity to electric utilities. Instead, it sets up clear rules and expectations for vegetation management. We have invited testimony on the line, and they're also available for questions. We have Crystal Inkvist, the Executive Director of APA, Andy Lehman, the General Counsel for the Power Association, Travis Million, the CEO for Copper Valley Electric, John Burns, President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric, and Jim Butler, the Advisor for Homer Electric Utility.
And Representative Rauscher, that's the full presentation at this point?
pretty much right now.
That's fine. We see if there are questions from the committee as to the bill sponsor and his staff. I would also note available for questions is Andy Lehman, General Counsel, Alaska Power Association, Travis Million, CEO of the Copper Valley Electric Association, Crystal Enquist for the Alaska Power Association, Jim Butler from the Homer Electric Association, and John Burns, the CEO of the Golden Valley Electric Association. I think when we get to invited testimony, we will hear from Ms. Enquist, Mr. Butler, and Mr. Burns, but go ahead with questions. And if you want to direct questions to any of the people in attendance, you certainly can. Representative Vance, you've been quiet, so you get to get ahead of the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a timely piece of legislation, and I'm not sure who to direct my question to. I think there's a variety of people who could answer this, but I'm curious as to last year's significant wildfires and how this piece of legislation would impact kind of a broader scope of fires and how the utilities would need to respond and where any liability may be had versus just a singular tree. I think that's something that is affecting more Alaskans right now that might be concerned about this.
Is that one for...
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, yeah. I think that I'd like either Crystal Enquist or maybe Andy Lehman or one of the CEOs to answer that one.
Why don't we start with Ms. Enquist, because she represents a group that represents all the electric utilities. Start with Ms. Enquist, and if others want to add, they can. Go ahead, Ms. Enquist.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. If it's all right, I would like to have that question answered by Andy Lehman, our general counsel.
Mr. Lehman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, through the chair, you know, what impact the bill would have is going to depend on what the cause of the fire is determined to be, right? And if it was because vegetation from outside the easement contacted a tree, then this says, you know, the utility's not going to be responsible for that. And, of course, if it's inside the easement, then you look at the vegetation management plan and whether the utility followed it. You know, the big wildfires that we had last year, you know, I'm not personally familiar with all the details of what the determination was of what the cause was, but it was, you'd certainly be looking at a bill like this in a situation where you had a fire around the utility line.
Follow up?
Mr. Chairman, if I may ask the Homer Electric to speak to the transmission line that was going through the Swan Lake Fire. I don't remember the status. I remember that there was a transmission line that Swan Lake Fire. Yes, that it received a considerable amount of damage. And was Homer Electric responsible for paying for getting that back online, or did that fall to the feds because it was a federal managed wildfire?
Mr. Butler, are you with us?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I can't tell if my line's been unmuted or not.
You're unmuted at this point. Go ahead. Did you understand the question from Representative Vance? And Mr. Butler, you shouldn't try to do any muting of your own phone. The folks here in the committee room actually have a higher and more skilled technology to mute you and unmute you than you may have on your own end. So if you just want to leave your phone unmuted, and they'll unmute you when we want to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for the inconvenience.
No problem.
I believe, if I heard the question correctly, it dealt with the Swan Lake Fire, which was the large fire that burned throughout most of the summer in the summer of 2019. That fire originated off the wildlife refuge and was started by lightning. It did come in through electrical facilities, and we worked quite closely with the different fire teams, but that was not a fire that originated as a result of a start from an electrical energized line. We have had those, however, in the, what we call the urban interface context, and those have typically been from either a failure to an old electrical facility, or they have been related to vegetation that has come in from outside of the right-of-way into the energized line. In each of those cases, we work with forestry to do an investigation and resolve any causal factors that might lead to assessment of suppression costs. Hopefully that answers your question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance, any follow-up?
Just for clarification, was Homer Electric held liable to repair those lines that were destroyed through that fire?
Representative Vance, through the chair, the damage to the line in the Swan Lake fire was a cost that was incurred by the utilities that operated that. That was a transmission line that carried electrical power from the peninsula up into the rail belt, and there were other parties involved in the ownership and administration outline. But yes, the repair cost to the facility was borne, was the responsibility of the utilities. It's the suppression cost that was the exposure that is a principal concern, because those costs can far exceed any potential coverage that a utility might have. Through the chair, thank you.
Follow-up?
I'm just thinking out loud here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, of just if this particular bill would have helped cover, you know, put the liability on to the federal government to pay for the repair of that transmission line, but it seems like I'm conflating two issues here, I think. So thank you for answering the questions.
I don't think that was a question. I will have a short follow-up on that. Is when you have damage to electric lines that are a cause of lightning started fires, is that there's the repair to the line just part of the cost of doing business in the utility world?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jim Butler again, on behalf of HA. I'll take the first attempt at that. Yes, in most cases, the loss of a damaged facility, if it's through sort of an act of God, if you will, where it's hard to find a third party that may be responsible. In most cases, that's a cost that's absorbed by the utility. And that's been the case on several of the large fires, at least we've had down on the peninsula. In other instances, we've had cases where people either through negligent operation of a vehicle or operating around a power line and damaging the facility. In those instances, the utility does look at options for pursuing a claim for third-party liability.
Mr. Lehman or Ms. Enquist, anything to add to Mr. Butler's comments on that question?
This is Crystal Enquist. I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions. I think it was the APA General Counsel or the HEA General Manager, I can't remember who was testifying, but there was mention about the cost of suppression being foremost of interest, and I think it'd be helpful. Well, what I took away from that comment is that it's being implied, although I'm not sure it's been stated, that the cost of suppression is a part of the liability that electric co-ops assume. Could that relationship be expounded on by either the sponsor or one of the invited testifiers?
Let's let either Ms. Enquist or Mr. Lehman take that question on. Start with Mr. Lehman. That sounds like a legal question.
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, and I do believe that that point was brought up by Mr. Butler, and he's got quite a bit of familiarity with it as well, so it may be worth hearing from him. But yes, I think the idea is that certainly suppression costs are, you know, are civil liability, and that if you've got a situation where, again, it's something that's outside the utility's control because, you know, you have a tree enter the easement that causes a fire, that we shouldn't be looking to the utility and its ratepayers to pay suppression costs for that.
Follow-up, Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you. And this concern that the bill is clarifying where liability ultimately exists, is there an instance that's happened thus far somewhere in Alaska in which an electric co-op has in fact assumed liability and paid for that liability for a fire that started because of vegetation that was outside its legal right-of-way and ultimately held responsible, held liable for that fire? For whomever.
I think we'll start with Mr. Lehman and then go to Ms. Enquist. And if neither of them can answer, then we'll try the other three. Mr. Lehman? Mr. Lehman, did you hear Representative Christ-Tompkins' question?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I failed to follow your advice about not muting my own. I apologize to the committee. I do believe there's been at least one case, I believe, that involved an electric utility where they sought suppression costs. I'm not sure that that was a tree matter. And, of course, sometimes I think when the state seeks suppression costs, it can be quite a while after the fire occurred. I can't think of an instance off the top of my head recently, but I wouldn't say that it hasn't happened. I think Mr. Butler might be familiar with some instances where that's happened.
Mr. Butler, anything to add to that, the response to Representative Christ-Tompkins' question?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Christ-Thompson, this is Jim Butler again on behalf of HEA. I would say that the instances of property damage seem to be more likely than the ones for wildland fire. However, wildland fire suppression costs are growing, as you might guess. Additionally, the concept of utilities being held responsible for the large suppression costs of wildland fire is a national trend. Regrettably, there's been, as I'm sure we're all aware, you know, pretty historic fires that have been a byproduct of that. And it is, I think it's just a matter of time before it gets here. But I think generally speaking, the utilities have tried to do a good job. It's whether or not vegetation from outside the utility could add to enough confusion in seeking the suppression costs for a high expense fire or a high damage fire, and how the utility might have to be forced to defend itself in fairly protracted litigation to get to a resolution.
Follow-up, Representative Christ.
Yeah, last follow-up. Thank you. That's helpful. So my takeaway is that this is mostly preemptive and prophylactic, but there's instances in the lower 48 that are sort of prompting this legislation. My last question is, as presented, it does seem a little bit powerless. Electric co-ops are in a little bit of a powerless position, that there would be vegetation outside their right-of-way that could potentially befoul their lines or cause a fire, et cetera, et cetera. And sorry, I follow that logically. I guess I'm surprised that the rights of way would be sufficiently narrow in the first place that you couldn't attend to vegetation that's problematic. So how is it that we're in a place where you have trees that are outside the legal right of way, therefore you can't do anything about them, that can take down your lines and cause wildfires and all of that?
And any of these folks you want to hear from?
Probably APA or somebody from one of the co-ops.
I'll let Mr. Butler take the first shot at it because he seems to be happy to offer some thoughts on these things, and then we may go to Mr. Lehman after that. Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Christ-Thompson. I guess what I'd like to do is just do a real quick 101 on what a right-of-way is. Obviously, a right-of-way is a portion of some property that allows the utility to run power lines through that area.
most of the right-of-ways are actually fairly narrow, anywhere between 20 to 30 feet. So imagine the line going down the middle. That means it's about 15 feet wide. And depending upon the height of the facility, i.e. the power line pole, many trees grow much taller than that and can easily blow or fall into that that energized facility and cause a fire. On private property, the ability to go in and clean those right-of-ways is limited in many cases because private property owners have to grant access. And it's that complicating factor where, as we all know, we like the vegetation, we like the trees, and getting right-of-ways cleared, in most cases, from, you know, sand, from the ground to the sky, most people don't prefer to have their trees trimmed or maintained over time. And it's over time, particularly in the area where we are with the spruce bark beetle infestation, it's problematic. But if that answers your question for the beginning, I'd probably defer to one of the experts from the utilities, as my background is not actually distributing electricity on wires. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Try Mr. Lehman. Anything to add in response to Representative Christ-Tompkins' question?
Yeah, I would just, I thank you through the chair. I certainly agree with what Jim said. Sometimes utility facilities, you know, are in another easement, like a highway easement, and so sometimes there isn't a lot of extra room, you know, to begin with. And then, of course, when you're talking about dedicated utility easements, you know, if it's a municipal or a public easement, the utility may not really even have any choice about how wide it is. And if you're talking about getting an easement from a utility customer, you know, most electric consumers in Alaska are served by co-ops, and most co-ops, you know, require, hey, if you're going to join the co-op and get service, you've got to provide a free easement so that we can serve you and serve your neighbors, and then everybody gets treated equally. And, of course, having those easements on your private property is a burden. As Mr. Butler said, the trees get cut. You can't build your house in the easement, right? You might even have to get permission if you want to do something like put a shed or a deck in it. So there are some good reasons why those tend to be kind of as narrow as possible to allow the utility to put the facilities in there and ideally get access for them and access for things like supporting, guy wires and things like that.
Thank you.
That's actually Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. A couple of questions about the scope of this. So we're talking on page one about civil liability, and I just wanted to ask, so in this case, would workers' compensation claims fall under that civil liability?
I think that's a question for Mr. Lehman. You're the lawyer on the line.
through the chair, no, I do not believe this would impact workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is a separate system of compensation for workplace injuries that's, you know, apart from our civil litigation system.
Follow up, Representative Eastman, or any other question, either one.
A follow-up. I'm curious just to know, you know, in what way is it not followed under there? So if we're precluding civil liability, can you explain to us a little bit about how that would not be interpreted at some point down the line to deny someone a workers' compensation claim?
Through the chair, that's certainly not the intent, Representative Eastman, and I understand where you're coming from. You know, it's certainly it's not criminal liability, but when you're talking, and I do not consider myself a workers' compensation lawyer, but you know, my understanding is that when you're talking about workers' compensation claims, we do have an administrative system that's set up for adjudicating those claims. The entire purpose, one of the purposes of workers' compensation is to preclude civil liability for employers for workplace injuries, right? That's part of the grand bargain of workers' compensation, that we don't have to fight over causation, but in exchange, the worker gets their workplace injuries taken care of. So it's I don't believe that is the intent or that would be the outcome of that civil liability language, because workers' comp and the obligation to pay insurance and to carry insurance and for insurers to pay those claims wouldn't be changed by this.
Thank you very much. Follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Yeah, at some point, maybe not today if they're not available, but I would like to hear from someone, you know, on the workers' advocate side to confirm that that's their interpretation as well. And I guess my question's stemming from having, you know, been involved with and heard of cases where, you know, as a firefighter, we dealt with some pretty nasty injuries dealing with these types of situations. And I'm curious, so if the liability is now not on the side of the utility, what other sidebars are there other than following a vegetation management plan? I mean, obviously, you know, I could write a vegetation management plan, or a utility could, that was lacking, shall we say, that only dealt with grass and ignored roots and trees and other things, and so you have a fire dealing with trees, and that just wasn't part of their management plan. So by the way I'm reading this, then they would be off the hook. But is there somewhere else that spells out all the different things that would have to be in that management plan?
Somebody online that can provide some response to what needs to go in a management plan.
This is Crystal. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ms. Enquist.
This is Crystal Enquist with Alaska Power Association. I think a good person to answer that would be Travis Million. He's the CEO of Copper Valley Electric Association. Prior to that, he was the chief operating officer. He did provide, for the record, their draft vegetation management plan.
Mr. Million.
Sure, through the chair. So kind of what you'll see in our plan is it gives, you know, some criteria regarding rotation of vegetation management, how often, and that would be, you know, based on what the utility sees prudent for the different areas that they serve. Also establishes the methods of clearing your right-of-way, what type of machine that's used, and, you know, the width of the right-of-way is based on where you're at and what your prescribed easements are. So that's kind of the generalized criteria that would be covered in a standard vegetation management plan. Some of them will have a lot more detail than others based on, I guess, kind of the area you're at. As you heard from people earlier on, you know, there's a lot of utilities in the state of Alaska that doesn't have any trees or vegetation to worry about.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I guess my question is, if we're dealing with utility and this law passes, and there's a vegetation management plan that says we are going to take a really good look at trees in our area every 20 years, and of course, you know, year 15, 16, 17, a fire happens, are they covered under this?
Mr. Million, if you want to answer that question, and if you're not comfortable, we'll turn next to Mr. Lehman.
Through the chair, I would defer to Mr. Lehman on the writing of that.
And Mr. Lehman, before you answer, I'll just add a little bit to the question, and then you can respond. At some level, doesn't the question about the adequacy of the plan, if the plan doesn't seem to work, go to the reasonableness of the plan itself, which may or may not come under question with time and circumstances?
Exactly.
You want to provide a little more detail on that?
Through the chair, yeah, I'm happy to. There is not a set standard in the statute or in the proposed law in HB 29 for what would go into a vegetation management plan for, I think, all the reasons Mr. Million mentioned, that, you know, you just have such different circumstances across the state in terms of what whether you have any vegetation at all, right? And then if you do, what is it? How fast does it grow? How susceptible is it to damage? You heard Mr. Butler talk, and I'm sure everybody's familiar with, you know, the issues dealing with the spruce bark beetle. So the idea was that you really, it'd be difficult to have a one-size-fits-all vegetation management plan. And, of course, even without the protection that's being offered by this bill, you'll find that utilities across Alaska already have vegetation management plans. I think as Jesse Keel mentioned, even in Kotzebue, where it's hard to come up with a lot of vegetation that could contact electrical facilities, that they've got a plan. So utilities already have these plans because they have to in order to be able to assure their operations. So, you know, my answer, well, what would stop a utility from just having a plan that said, our plan is to have no plan, or our plan is to look every 50 years. No utility is going to do that because they won't be able to operate. The utilities already have all kinds of incentives operationally and financially to protect their transmission lines. The issue is that even if they do everything that they can under these plans that they've developed to protect their ratepayers and in many cases their member owners, if it's a co-op, they still can be sued and say, well, that wasn't, you know, we didn't think you were reasonable enough. So the idea is that by tying it to these vegetation management plans that the utilities already have and already have all kinds of incentives to make sure they'll get the job done, that provides a clear standard that the utilities and their ratepayers can rely on.
Yeah, follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And how should the committee understand the entirely within language on line 14 of page 1? If are we talking about, you know, a standalone tree that's entirely within? What about a root system that, you know, has part of it in the area, maybe not? A patch of grass, I suppose, could be in or out. Likewise, shrubbery that started outside and then ends inside. What exactly do we mean by that entirely within?
Through the chair, obviously since the...
Please identify yourself for the record so we know who's talking.
Apologies. This is Mr. Lehman.
Go ahead.
Yes. Through the chair, the entirely within language was in there, I think, because there is a difference, right, in how you evaluate liability for something the utility could control, vegetation that's within the easement and vegetation that's outside of it. The idea was, you know, you might have a situation where a tree or something, right, growing on the easement boundary, maybe it is partially inside the easement, but you know, the fear would be that if it's also outside the easement, then is that tree really completely within the utility's control? And it probably has to work with a landowner who again may or may not be willing to cooperate with something like that. And I'm sure from the utility perspective, they would much rather deal with a tree like that. And in fact, a lot of utilities will trim or remove trees that are even outside the easement if they really think it's going to threaten the power line. But again, that requires cooperation with the landowner that's not always there.
Representative Kirka has been waiting quite a while for asking questions. You've had several. I'm going to let Representative Kirka have a few questions, and then we'll see. We are going to get through public testimony on this bill today, so we may have to hold some of your questions, Representative Eastman. Go ahead, Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to some of the comments or questions earlier from Representative Vance along that same line, and there were several comments or mentions of the spruce bark beetle kill or devastation. I'm kind of wondering about the liability for the state of Alaska for its large amounts of land or for the federal government So I can see a scenario where, well, not just a scenario, it seems like there's a lot of complaints about maybe lack of good stewardship with dead tree management with the spruce bark beetle problem. And it would seem to me that to be consistent or I don't know if this bill, I haven't really fully examined it yet, addresses it, but that possibly a scenario like the Swanson Lake fire, where you have such an out-of-control beetle kill problem with lots of dead trees, which is a really dangerous situation for a massive forest fire, that you have exceptional damage to a utility corridor. And possibly
Representative Kirby, about the 1 minute and 5 minute mark, if you have a question you need to ask.
So my question is, would this affect at all liability for large property owners who do a poor job of stewardship of their property in terms of vegetation?
And I'll let Mr. Lehman try to answer that question because I think he's the only attorney on the line.
Through the chair, thank you. You know, the this bill is a shield. It's not a sword. It does not, I think, really assist change the situation one way or the other for a utility if it thinks its facilities have been damaged by anyone, whether it's someone crashing a vehicle into a pole or someone causing a fire. It really is just about what happens when you have a tree that or other form of vegetation that contacts a power line.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I guess the follow-up would be, would it be appropriate to consider that an amendment or just in terms of the consequences of to be consistent?
Mr. Lima, do you have any opinion about an amendment that addresses the liability of adjacent property owners, whether they be a private property owner or whether they be a governmental property owner? And if you don't have an opinion, that's okay.
Yeah, through the chair, I'm not sure I have. It's an interesting question, but I don't have an opinion at this time.
Any further follow-up, Representative Kirka? Representative Eastman, we'll take a couple more questions, then we're going to go to public testimony.
May I get in the queue?
Oh, absolutely. I'll actually, Representative Eastman, you've had several questions. Representative Snyder, you can get a few questions in.
I apologize. Thank you. I've had my hand up. I don't want anybody to think I'm trying to jump in line. I know it's hard to see. Thank you, Chair. I wanted to follow up just to make sure I understood an answer to Representative Eastman's question. So if a tree is growing either on the boundary of the easement or outside of the easement, if a limb grows into the easement, is it correct that the utility is not responsible or is not allowed to remove that limb? Is that correct?
I'm going to get Mr. Million to answer that because he'll probably tell us what their practices are, and they actually have a vegetation clearance plan in there.
Mr. Million, and through the chair, the way we practice ours is our easement or our right-of-way is for most places 30 feet wide ground to sky. So we have pieces of equipment that allows us to stay within our right-of-way and mow the trees or cut the trees, the limbs that are coming out inside our easement and encroaching our line. So if there's a tree outside the right-of-way, but the limb is coming inside the right-of-way, we have the means to clear it. And that's how we practice it in our utility.
Great. Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Snyder.
I would not suggest that a utility would find any value in not continuing that practice of removing limbs that cross into, but it seems to me the way the bill is currently worded, it could release them from liability should they not clear those limbs with the verbiage around if it's not completely within the easement. So I'm worried about a possible loophole there, however slim it might be, that it's taken advantage of. I provide the opportunity for comment on that or clarification of interpretation.
Mr. Million, I'll give you the first shot at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, I would say, you know, one of our main drivers for being an electric co-op in, you know, in the state of Alaska and pretty much anywhere in the United States is reliable, economic, safe electric services for our members. So even if there was some sort of a small loophole or whatnot that way from the liability standpoint, you know, that could affect our reliability to our members. So just from good utility practice, we would be clearing those whether there was a liability loophole or not, just because of the reliability of the electric service to our members.
Any further follow-up?
Thank you. I had a second question, but I'm happy to get back in queue.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Would it be possible to be provided with a general breakdown of the different entities that are adjacent to the easements? I guess I'm trying to get a broad understanding of, say, the percent, when we're talking about who the liability might be shifted to, the percent of shifted to the state, shifted to the feds, shifted to individual Alaskans. Any 30,000-foot general estimates of that as we understand the implications?
Anybody want to offer to take that on? I'm not going to guess at this point. Miss may be the best option.
Mr. Chairman, John Burns, if I might.
All right, Mr. Burns. Haven't heard from you, so give you a shot.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. So for the record, John Burns, President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association. I just wanted to be clear that there is no shifting of liability. That's really important to understand. It's not as if a utility is trying to avoid any responsibility for that which they control. The clarification that's being requested here is within the context of a right-of-way, that's the only area that a utility such as Golden Valley or Copper Center or anybody, any utility has the authority to control. Beyond that, okay, if Golden Valley were to arbitrarily go onto your property and expand its right-of-way, okay, we would be subject to trespass and potentially, you know, treble damages under state statute. So what we're focused on is liability for that which we control. So all that this legislation is seeking to do is clarify that a utility is not liable for trees or vegetation that is outside of its right-of-way, that falls into its right-of-way and, for example, cuts across our electric utility line. So in Fairbanks, for example, we are, you know, we have 2,600 miles of right-of-way, again, of lines within, you know, right-of-way easements. And we have a vegetation management plan. We try to, you know, clear on a five-year cycle, and we spend a tremendous amount of money in doing it, about $3 million annually in trying to do that. Our big concern here is that with the proliferation of growth on trees and that, it's, you know, in the storm and the winds that we are getting, I'll just use Fairbanks as an example. We are having freezing rain now, so oftentimes in November and December, in weather patterns that we're not used to, heavy winds. So if a tree that's 60 foot tall, that's outside of a 30-foot easement, and remember, a 30-foot easement is one side to the other. We often build in the middle of that easement. So we're, you know, as Mr. Millian said, 15 feet on either of the center line. So we try to put our electric poles right through the middle of a 60 or a 30-foot easement. So if you've got a tree that's 60 feet tall, a tall spindly spruce tree, for example, and it's 2 feet or 3 feet outside of the right-of-way, and a heavy wind comes and knocks that tree into our line and causes a fire, what this bill says is that Golden Valley is not liable for that fire. Okay? It doesn't say somebody else is liable for it. It just makes it very clear that Golden Valley or the utility would not be liable for that, provided, okay, that it's got a vegetative management plan, all this other stuff. But in that situation, I just want to make it clear that the Golden Valley is, or this legislation is not seeking to shift responsibility at all. And I liken it to the fact that if you have a tree on your lawn, in your property, and that tree falls in across my property and knocks down my fence, it's not my responsibility as the fence owner to bear that liability. It's your responsibility as the owner of the property where the tree sits. And so that's just to make it clear in that regard. And I really appreciate the dialogue. It's very interesting, and these are great questions. And I'm happy to go back and answer several of the other ones just from our practical, how we operate here. But I just want to make it very clear what the focus of this legislation is aimed at.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. It is now almost 10 to 3. We have to stop a minute or so before 3. I'm going to open public testimony on this because here's the only people that are available for public testimony are the people we've already been hearing from. We're going to let them have their chance at public testimony. We're going to close public testimony. And then I'm going to give Representative Eastman a couple of questions, Representative Vance a couple of questions. And just to let you know, we're going to stop a minute or two before 3 because I actually have to attend a Zoom funeral starting right at 3. So we are opening public testimony on House Bill 29, and the only people online are Andy Lehman, Travis Million, Crystal Enquist, Jim Butler, and John Burns. And I would open it if any of you think – I think we all understand that you all support this bill, and – that you're the companies or the associations that you work with support this bill. Is there anything you'd like to add by way of additional testimony that you haven't said already, recognizing that I expect we'll have another, at least one more hearing on this bill, and you'll have a chance to testify here. But is there anything you'd like to add to what you've said already? And I'll go down the list. Mr. Lehman, anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, no.
Mr. Million.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity, and I'll withhold at this point in time because we covered pretty much everything that I was going to testify on.
Ms. Enquist, anything to add?
Not at this time. Several points in my testimony were covered. Thank you.
This is always a good product when we can get there. Mr. Butler, anything to add?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. One clarification, if I might. Due to my lack of technical skills, I was not able to actually introduce myself for the record. Jim Butler with Baldwin & Butler. I am an attorney, and I have worked with HEA for many years, and my practice is dealing primarily with incident management. So these types of issues are something I confront from a bunch of different angles. But I apologize if that wasn't clear earlier, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
And thank you for the clarification. I, for some reason, had the idea that you were the CEO of Homer Electric, and obviously I'm mistaken, and appreciate the clarification. And last, Mr. Burns, anything additional to add?
You know, the only thing I would add is relative to the vegetative management plans themselves, I think there was a question by or a comment by Representative Eastman that, you know, for Golden Valley, just like, Travis Million's utility, we have a vegetative management plan. It's best practices. It's always evaluated, but it's, as I think you yourself, Mr. Chairman, said, it's the reasonableness of the plan that is evaluated. Okay, just because you have a plan doesn't make it, you know, an appropriate plan. And so you're not, just by having a plan that says we're not going to have a plan, that's not a reasonable plan. And that will always come into question. And again, you know, it's not shifting liability, it's just posing liability for that which you have control over.
Thank you very much, and I would note that Mr. Burns, in addition to being, he is the CEO of the Golden Valley Electric Association, but he's also a licensed attorney. Are you still licensed, or have you retired from your law practice, Mr. Burns?
No, I'm still a licensed attorney.
Okay. So I don't hear any other public testimony. See no one else in the queue, so I'm going to close public testimony. And Ms. Representative Eastman, I told you I'd give you a couple more questions. I'm going to give you two questions and give Representative Vance two questions, and then if there are more questions, then we can continue those. Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Thank you. And my question is the legal effect here of the liability shield that we are giving to the utility. What I don't see any exception here or exemption for negligence. So does this preclude a utility being held liable for a claim of negligence on the part of the utility?
Did anybody want to have answer that question?
Is Representative Eastman? Is that an open-ended question to anybody?
Well, who spoke up first, and we'll let you have the first shot.
Yeah, I'm sorry, John Burns here,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. I didn't know if that was...
Go ahead, Mr. Burns. You can answer the question.
Yeah. Yeah, it's to the extent, just the answer is no, okay, from this perspective. To the extent that we undertake, just, you know, the standard, you know, assumption of the risk and, you know, negligence, to the extent that we fail to do something which we should have done, which is within our control, okay, then... that would, you know, we would not be shielded from negligence, but, you know, from the standpoint of our right-of-ways, side-to-side clearing it, then, you know, I don't see how we would be negligent within that context, but it would not shield us from basic negligence. I don't see that. It's just saying, you know, no shifting of liability. We are not liable for that which we cannot control, period. If we can control it, we're negligent. I mean, if we fail to do it, then we'd be negligent. That's how I view it. Andy or somebody else? Jim?
Mr. Chairman, Sandy Lehman, could I address that?
Mr. Lehman, go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair. What this really does, I think, HB 29, is it really makes it clearer what the legal standard is that the utility is going to be held to. In the absence of HB 29, Representative Eastman, you're exactly right. It would be, well, was the utility negligent to some degree? And if so, we're going to hold them responsible. And, of course, that's a wonderful situation for lawyers to go argue about whether a utility was negligent or not. HB 29 makes it clearer for everyone, for landowners and for utilities, when a utility is going to be liable for a wildfire that resulted from vegetation contacting the facilities. If it's within, if that vegetation is outside the easement, they're not going to be liable. If they are, you're going to look at the vegetation management plan and when the utility follows it. So I guess in the industry's mind, it's really providing more certainty and more clarity than you would get with a negligence standard, which, of course, is just very general and with lots of room for lawyers to argue about what it means.
And follow-up?
One follow-up and then Representative Vance. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. So I guess that a question that might be asked later is there anything, you know, wrong in pulling out, you know, liability for negligence or gross negligence here, since that doesn't seem to be what the bill is about. There's also the question of timing. And negligence can happen after the fire has already happened. And so it's not a question of negligence on the vegetation management plan, but, you know, sometime after that fire has taken place. So my question is on timing. So, you know, we've had fires where it's been vegetation contact, fire, very straightforward, all happens at one time. We've also had calls where we go out and the fire hasn't happened yet, but you can see the sparking, you can see the vegetation contact and wire and so forth. So at what point does the liability happen? I mean, at some point that vegetation is located entirely within the boundaries, but maybe the fire doesn't start for a week or a few days or a month. So what is the intent on that?
Who do you want to answer the question?
That question can be open to anyone.
We'll start with Mr. Lehman.
Well, through the chair, yeah, I guess I would just turn back to the language of the bill, right? That if the tree that eventually caused the fire by contacting the facility, you know, if it was outside the easement, it's got the standard in there. If it's inside the easement, it's the other standard. And of course, if you have vegetation, and this is something that maybe our operational folks could address. I mean, you're not going to have, I think, a situation where vegetation is sitting for a week on a power line without that becoming very obvious operationally and something that somebody would be doing something about quickly. So I'm not sure that's likely to happen.
All right. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will make it quick. The first one is a statement that maybe we need to speak to our legislative intent of what a reasonable management plan is that may help, you know, for the future. But my question is to the utilities. This bill specifically speaks to vegetation and the liability. Are there instances of liability that involve a buildup of ice that causes damage or possible flooding that is not being addressed?
Through the chair, John Burns, I can't, you know, speaking from Golden Valley's perspective, I'm not aware of that type of an incident in our service territory.
You want to hear from Mr. Butler with Homer?
Yes, please.
Mr. Butler, if you could answer the same question.
Sure. Representative Vance, through the chair, I'm not aware of most of those types of circumstances, which arguably are, you know, act of God or somewhat of a force majeure beyond the ability of the utility to practically manage for. They manage their facilities for reliability, and that's pretty much safety and reliability are job number one. So if something that was outside the control of the utility caused the problem, then I guess that would probably be beyond the scope of what this bill's trying to do. This, as I understand it, this bill's trying to just make clear that if you adopt best practices and have an effective vegetation management plan, that the lines of responsibility and liability are clear and not as ambiguous as they are now. Thank you.
Well, we're just a couple of minutes before three, so we're gonna stop discussion. I think Representative Snyder, you may have some further follow-up questions when we come back, and we can turn to those. And Representative Vance, you may have had more as well. I'm not sure if you got that was all the questions you had, but we will hold this bill for further review, and we can take up those questions. I will ask if the folks that were available for public or for questions today be available the next time we hear this bill. I'm not sure when we'll schedule the bill, but I will announce the in terms of amendments to House Bill 29, those will be due at 5 p.m. on Friday, March 26th. That's this Friday, and as always, they'd be due to my office by electronic means no later than 5 p.m. I don't know for sure when we'll hear the bill again, but I did want to get that amendment deadline in so that we can keep the process moving forward. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 24 at 1:30 p.m., and we will stand adjourned. It's now, looks like it's right at 3 o'clock.